special occasion. This is a very special hour-long live call-in show for Filmically Perfect on 91.3 WYSO. Hello and good day to you. I'm Nikki Dakota, joined in the studio live and in person, and it's been a long time coming. So glad to see the both of you. First storyboard artist for the Coen brothers and many famous movies that we all know and love, he's J. Todd Anderson.
We're back. We cannot be stopped.
And also on your radio right, the largest frame brain in the history of film knowledge, also an iTrade film archivist for the Library of Congress. And all of our favorite film guy, he's George Willeman. George.
I deny any knowledge of that.
Our man from the Library of Congress.
28 years and counting.
Our man from the Library of Congress.
We have come here for the purpose of kicking off a new season of shows. Are we going to give any indication of some of the delicacies coming
out?
Yeah,
we can tell you a few of those shows.
Yeah.
We're going to have two of the greatest made-for-TV movies ever made in the history.
And this is a first for us.
Absolutely. We've never done that before, but we're not going to disappoint you. One is, can you do that music? Brian's song.
Oh, no, don't say it.
It makes us cry.
It's so sad.
Not to be topped by Duel.
Steven which reminds me of
the masterpiece of the world.
Reminds me of driving down I-95 through Virginia.
If you've ever experienced road rage or dished it out, you're going to like this picture.
Steven Spielberg's first film ever.
Yeah,
and
we also got
his
feature
so
film ever.
Oh, okay.
We also have movies made many years ago that are more prone to modern times, like The Incredible Shrinking Man.
And The Hunchback of Notre Dame,
yes,
Charles Laughton.
A little bit in common there. And we have one of the best anti-union, pro-union, you make up your mind movie on the waterfront.
That's right.
I remember seeing that as a kid, and it has stuck with me ever since.
And we also have some really fine shtick, you know. Now, we know that Brian's song is just completely, you know, out of control with shameless
rank emotionalism.
Yeah. But we have where it's okay to – we have a movie that's been called many things, and it has Hope and Crosby, and it's called On the Road to Morocco.
Which I got to watch the first part of last
but
night.
But one of many. We
good,
we think that's the
white.
Best one.
Yeah.
You're going to remember that. And plus, most of the prints on that are really beautiful. It's Paramount at their finest.
Right.
Back when they were making a lot of movies. And then we have one of the greatest sort of musical movies ever made, Cat Ballou, which was really a fantastic movie, and it still is. I think
it's strange, sort of a comedy, reflective, musical, western thing.
And it's got really wonderful segues where Nat King Cole and his banjo-playing pal come out of the woodwork and just start playing, and they tell you the song, the narrative.
All right. Well, don't tell them anymore.
Oh, don't tell them anymore.
You have to listen in later.
Yeah.
These are all new episodes coming up of Filmically Perfect on 91.3 WYSO. Go ahead and call. Get in line right now to talk live to the film guys. The number is 800-776-0090. That's 800, toll free. 776-0090. We had a call earlier today, gentlemen. Michael Trimmerwhip called in from Dayton. He wanted to ask you, according to him, and he can't remember which, there was a movie that marked the very first occasion when the end credits became so exhaustive and encyclopedic. So many names listed.
I believe it was Superman.
So very modern.
I think it's Superman.
You mean when the credits, tail end credits were
end
huge?
Credits, yes. I mean, because Superman, if I remember correctly, the credits are so long they actually have to start the music over at the end.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because everybody got credit. You know, even Cheerios gets a credit.
Really?
I believe
now, you know, that credit roll is usually included with the duration of the movie. When you pick up a box that says 106 minutes, that's inclusive. So your actual
credits.
Picture, it could be about 98 minutes nowadays. If you've ever sat there and watched every Asian, every Brazilian, every Indian rotoscoping artist that's on these movies, you're going to be there for a while. You may as well just go out and get another drink because...
And what precipitated that? Do we know why that switched?
Probably. I mean, it kind of starts around the time of Star Wars, late 70s, and it could be an issue with the unions where everybody decided, hey, you know, you're giving credit to everybody else. What about us?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, on some films I've seen credits for the honey wagon driver.
Okay, what
And for
is
those
that?
Of you who don't know, that's the truck they take out to the site so people can use the bathroom. It's called the Honey Wagon.
But in motion pictures, what we have is when they talk about motion pictures and the production of motion pictures, what they have is above the line and below the line.
And below the belt.
But above the line is usually talent, directorial, you know, the music composer, really
producer,
the big time writer. Credits, the guys that make a lot of money. And then the below the line is everybody else. And theoretically, you can make a movie for real, when they say below the line costs are like $10 million, but the above the line costs are $50 million. And that's because, you know, famous guys like John Travolta are getting 10 up front, and the movies are completely lopsided because the above the line people make a lot more money than below the line. So in theory, your movie can be made at a franchise cost of like 50 cents, but the above the line would be $50 million. Now I'm exaggerating, of course.
Maybe that's part of the
It's not far from the truth in the movie business, let me tell you.
Below the line, your name in the film at all is a part of your pay.
Well, you know, like what you're seeing, what we're talking about, all those people are below the line. And usually those credits, now, there have been people who have bucked that trend, like putting directed by at the very last thing you see at the end of the movie. That was something that started coming on, I don't know, what do you think, 20 years ago, George?
Something like, yeah.
Because I remember Joel did that on Blood Simple years ago, directed by. And now it became kind of a...
It's now the thing to do.
Yeah.
But originally they had to get, I remember George Lucas, I believe, had to get special waiver or permission to have his name at the end as director from the DGA.
It's very political.
Because originally the agreement was that the director's credit appears the last thing you see before the movie starts. So to put it at the end. They may be different now because he kind of bucked the trend, but originally that's the way it was.
One down. Calls looking for your questions for the film guys. Call, write this number down if you're in transit, 800-776-0090. Again, that's 800-776-0090. And get to a telephone ring through to the studio in this very special hour-long.
We're special.
Call-in show with the film guys.
George is special.
My mother said I'm special.
We have Jim
they
calling
tell
in.
Us we're special.
It is so obvious.
I'm the special boy.
We have Jim calling in from North.
Down.
We have Jim calling in from North Dayton. And hello, Jim. Are you there?
I am. How are you?
Hi. Welcome to Filmically Perfect.
Thank you. First of all, I've got to say thank you guys for doing this show. It is great entertainment, and we never miss it.
Oh, shucks.
Torn
nothing. Thank you.
Your 4th of July show was phenomenal.
Thank you. Yeah.
But my question is, what is the longest commercially viable film, and how short does a film have to be considered a short?
I guess commercially viable might be a term also. I mean, I guess maybe returned money.
The where I find in the old films that I work with, where the breaking point seems to be for shorts versus features is a short can run up to 4 reels. We have some – I mean, they're lengthy shorts, but they are considered a short. On the other hand, a lot of the B-movie features from the 30s and 40s were 5 reels. So they run just a little under an hour. So the breaking point seems to be between 4 and 5 reels. At least that's what it was during the golden age.
And let me tell you, when George brings his shorts in here, we have to get out of the
lengthy
studio.
Shorts.
That's right. I do. I have some of the longest shorts in the business.
So I guess it's sort of like a varying thing.
Now, as for longest viable film, you mean the longest film that a person can stay awake during?
Well, no, the longest – where does the studio say that's too long? People won't sit through it. You know, it's got to be shorter than X.
It seems like 2 hours and 10 minutes is usually the breaking point anymore.
And is there some really psychological thing about that, I wonder?
Really good book to read is – The Making of Heaven's Gate. You'll get a lot of that up your nose when you read that book because that was – Cimino, they made him go out and cut a whole bunch out of the movie, and he comes back. He's only cut like 3 minutes out.
Right. You know? And a lot of it, of course, depends on the studio's attitude with the director because like Orson Welles, not a single film of his came out the way he intended it to. And Eric von Stroheim, I mean, when he was working on Greed, his original cut was over 8 hours long. Now it's a little over 100 minutes.
Now, you know, one of the things that what happens usually, it's studio versus director. And that's what usually happens because the directors fall in love with these things called temp tracks. rough cuts. And what I'm talking about is like music that they put in there to get the movie done and before they get score done. But they fall in love with this stuff. And they fall in love with their rough cuts, which can, you know, if a movie's 100 minutes long, the rough cut could be anywhere from 2 hours to 3 hours. And then that's when they have to separate. For instance, Blade Runner is a movie we're going to do. And there's a big deal on that because the director went back there and made Ridley Scott went back there and had to do his cut, which was a little bit longer, I think.
Right. Yeah, it is. And some things are, you know, some sounds are changed. Voiceovers are taken out. Other scenes are put back in.
And it's all about a viable commodity called a movie you can sell in the theater. And mm-hmm. that's what it's all about. It's...
Jim, we're going to move on. Thanks for calling
all
in.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to be on the phone with the film guys, you'll need to go ahead and go to the phone and call 800-801-9976. That's 800-801. No, that's you know what? It's the that's the pledge line number. It's actually different.
You can pledge
you
to
can
us.
You can pledge to us. Yes.
Pledge to the film guys.
That's right.
We pledge that we will agree with everything you say and that you're wonderful and there's no scale to your understanding. Nice little pledges like that.
And bring donuts.
Bring donuts. It's 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. Jay Todd, we had another call this morning. People have been calling all
well,
morning.
That guy's just too late now,
too
isn't
late.
He? We're
yeah.
in the
and
studio.
Now, he wanted to know how it was that you first met the Coen brothers and how you convinced them to hire you. And I want you to remind us
I'm not
going to.
It's a very, very long story.
No, I'm going to sit down.
But I'm not going to do that. I'll just do the short version.
Okay. All right.
And what it is as I was very persistent, I met them, I auditioned, and they hired me in a
it
nutshell.
It seems so smooth and easy.
It does, but it was not. Here's the thing. Persistence. I know so many more people out there in the business that have really become successful, even though a lot of people sworn to everybody that there's no talent there, but because of their persistence, they got it done. Persistence is the way anything is done. And that's how I met those guys. And I had seen Blood Simple with George, and we really appreciated their work because they were our age. And they look like kind of the guys that we were kind of idol worshiping at the time, like Spielberg and all that. There was a whole crew of
which
them that
the,
we really
the
liked.
Elder statesman in a way,
right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was all those guys were guys that we looked up to. And then the brothers came along and did this really nice movie. And George and I had made this little movie called Don't Tread on Me. And we had storyboarded it. And it was very similar. But the short answer is you have to be persistent if you really want it.
We've got another call on the line. I want to go to that. But I wanted to ask actually just my own curiosity. What was the first non-Coen Brothers movie that you storyboarded?
The first movie I storyboarded was Raising Arizona. Now, I worked in made-for-TV land for three movies, the Dallas television show stuff, and then I did this thing called Thompson's Last Run. Those were horrifying experiences. And I was ready to come back to Dayton and work at Rice department stores after those because they were so terrible. But fortunately, Robert Mitchum was a really nice guy, and he took me under his wing, and
wow.
He was a real star. And then I met the brothers, and it was a whole different world. Those guys were there to make movies, and that's what George and I are pretty much dedicated to doing. So
we have Eileen on the line. Eileen's listening in Kettering today, and I think she has a bone to pick for one of your perfect movie picks. Eileen, are you there?
Yeah, it's not exactly a bone.
No.
Really?
No.
It's not one of those rubber bone pet things that you give to your dog or anything.
No, not even that.
Okay.
Although
it's shaped like a bone.
So
okay.
After I tell you what movie it is.
Okay.
It's Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh, we love that movie.
The Eighth Dimension.
Ooh, that's a great movie.
Is it a great movie?
No, it's on our list. We've actually
we did
reviewed
it.
That.
It's on our list.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
George,
we saw that.
I love
we,
that movie.
We were fortunate to see that in the theater.
Ooh.
When it was first out.
Tiki.
And we sat there the whole time and it was like, Adford was like, this is great. And we knew that it was going to be great for us when a young person in the front yelled out, that was terrible, after it was over. We knew
that
it was going to be our film.
What a schmuck.
Yeah.
Yes, that is it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
John Lithgow gives the best performance.
He's great.
Yes. Laugh away you can, monkey boy.
Yeah, laugh away you can.
No, that's one of those
that's
enduring catchphrases,
yes.
Too. So actually, it was a situation of great minds thinking alike without
everyone
knowing.
Yeah, if you go up to either iTunes, I think, and it should be on our website in the archive.
That would be perfect movie.
Okay.
Yeah, you can hear our
.net.
Mindless commentary on that if you just go to perfectmovie.net.
Okay, that would be lovely.
Oh,
well, great. So, Buckaroo Banzai, Eileen from Kettering, thanks for calling today.
Thanks, Eileen.
Thank you.
If you'd like to call and be on the air with the film guys, you can do that at 800-776-0090. Again, that's 800-776-0090. George, you first came through Wright State University and were a film student. That's how the film guys met. And in fact, it was one of the questions that we had on the promo leading in. And do you guys remember the first
time? Talking about
my
hair again?
Well, we're going to talk about that later.
Okay.
Do you remember the first time you met?
Yeah, we were in the same class.
Yeah, we were in one of the preliminary film production classes, and it was very evident after a couple of classes that we both had the same rather demented view of filmmaking and the same kind of sense of humor. So we started working, you know, we got together and started working on each other's projects, and the rest is history.
George is always in all my movies. He's like he's always the guy up front.
That's
and
right.
I got to tell you, because I was just getting into movies back then, George had been studying them since he was really small.
Third grade.
And I always tell everybody, you surround yourself with people who have more talent than you'll ever dream of, and you'll probably, you know, get something done. And that's why I hung out with George, because George knew more about movies than anybody I'd ever met. And I had seen a lot of these movies. I just couldn't identify them because they were on television. And George helped me. He kind of guided me to understand what – because like I've said many times in the Super 60s, at night television went off at 12 o'clock. And then they show movies all night long. And that's what I did all summer, was watch movies till 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't know George could identify those movies. He could. I'm not kidding you. And a lot of those were the greatest movies ever made, because that's why television bought them. Because it's hard to believe and hard to fathom right now, if you're young, that's what they ran all night long, was movies all night long on Friday and Saturday and Sunday. At 6 o'clock, some would be coming up, and then they'd have the news. You know, during the week, they'd have played the national anthem, and it was done. You were still making out with your girl on the couch, you know. Until the old man came downstairs.
So I think it's fair to say that you guys had film in your blood. I mean, you just
Well, I was just discovering it. And George had already been there and done that so many times, he was bumping into himself.
Uh-huh.
And one of our shows is going to have our famous professor, Dr. Charles Derry. And George was like the sideshow in that. He had all the information. It was like internet. You know, George, which one is that one? George would tell him, you know. And this is all true. I'm not exaggerating here. That's how it was. And we developed our list way back then.
Indeed. And that was one of the first things when we finally met that you told me about this. I said, well, let's talk about this on the radio. And it's been
Absolutely.
A lot of fun. It's been since August 4th, 2006. We've been doing this coming up on 6 years.
Those women always keep track of stuff like that, don't they?
It.
Yeah, my wife does that.
I'm not sure what. That one's sorry about that.
We got a studio audience in here. Somebody tripped over the phone.
We do. There we go. Here we go. We're going now to Gary, listening in Dayton. And he has a movie that he would like to suggest. Gary, welcome to Filmically Perfect.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Hello.
So
Hello, Gary.
Yeah, hello. I think we were all, yes.
Go ahead.
I think I called before and I asked you guys about the President's Analyst with James Coburn.
Oh, yes. I just actually found a DVD copy of that somewhere back in Virginia, and I sat down and watched it, and it's just, in fact, right after that, the next day I went to work and I looked in our system, and we actually have an original Technicolor IB Technicolor print of that Paramount gave us back in the early 70s. So I'm trying to get it shown at our theater in Culpeper.
For people out there, when we say Technicolor, and it's getting a little long in the tooth because people don't remember, what Technicolor was the first, you know, fully automated color process for movies like Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz. And what that was, you have to kind of think about this. It was three negatives that were three different colors, and they registered into color. And one of the things that makes all those Technicolor movies look so beautiful is that they were printer's inks. They weren't vegetable dyes. That's why they're so rich and so colored. Now, they're not sharp and clear like you're used to seeing nowadays with digital, but there is a romantic kind of vision about these things when you see them. The red shoes, Dorothy's red shoes, that's all Technicolor working on your senses right there.
So this one was tell me, Gary, how do you know about this movie? Obviously, you saw it and it stayed with you.
You can get the DVD. They got a release on DVD right now. You can buy. I bought a new one.
Right. It's going to be getting a little hard to find because I believe Paramount is closing up all their. I mean, they're starting to clear out the warehouses of all their discs. So because so many of the companies,
but, you know, like, I think there was some sort of legal problem with this movie because there's a scene that they actually cut out where James meets his girlfriend. And I've seen it one time where they were at a film showing of an art picture or something. And they actually showed the picture on the screen.
Oh, okay. So maybe they couldn't get the rights to, or they didn't want to pay for the rights to show the
screen,
film again.
A film within
that's
a
probably
film.
What it is.
Yeah, because that scene is not on the DVD. I'll have to see if our print probably has that scene in it.
Would that movie be classified as a black comedy?
Oh, yes. It's a black psycho comedy.
Without hesitation. Yeah.
And very political, too.
Godfrey Cambridge, or how do you pronounce his name?
Godfrey Cambridge.
Yeah. Watermelon Man. Yeah. That was a great movie.
And that scene where they're in some sort of city where they're walking around with the other actor, and every scene where they're changing clothes.
Yes.
And I just think that's so cool.
Well, okay. Well, this will be a little heads up, little tip of the hand to see of things to come. So if you can get your hands on it, President's Analyst, maybe this will be coming up on.
I would say almost definitely. It's okay. There's not another film like it.
Gary, thank you very much for calling in, Gary from Dayton.
Thanks, Gary.
Stand by. We've got a gentleman phoning in from Xenia. I do believe that this will be John from Xenia. John, welcome. Well, here we go. There you go. Welcome to Filmically Perfect.
John, are you?
There he is. John, I bet you hear me now.
Oh, yeah, I hear you now. Do you hear me?
Hello, John.
Welcome to Filmically Perfect. What's your question for the film guys?
Yeah, it's more of a question more related to Jay Todd. And also,
well, I'll sit down again.
A little bit of advice for listeners. If you want to see movies, go to the public library. They've got... like everything.
Well, you know, we get a lot of, you know, we're working on some sort of sponsorship with anybody that can provide these movies, because a lot of the titles we pick out are really obscure, and the only people that find them are people that go to the library.
How about it?
And we always tell people, go to the library, you might find it there, but we can't really tell you specifically where to go. Like Louis Benoit movie we did, it was really hard to find. Exterminating Angel was a really hard movie. Yeah, Wooden Cross.
And think about Eyes on the Prize, which I only learned through the film guys, is it had a limited lease on much of this archival footage, and it can't be re-released. So the only way you can find it,
and then you have to be real careful.
Find it at the library.
Yes.
You have to be real careful which cut you're going to look at, because you might be looking at an incomplete cut, and that's where George comes in. You can send a letter to us, and George will specifically point you. Like Elvis, the Elvis movie we did. There's a really good cut of that, and then his family got in there and messed it all up, and there's a bad cut. But the one that really shows Elvis all the way. What was it?
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is, and that's what. The library is a very, very valuable, although it's not as valuable as it used to be with the research desk. You know, you used to call them up. Now you do it on the internet. But you can get great movies there.
And let me just say,
we rented – well, we signed out Paul. And
Paul?
Paul?
I just want to mention
that's not
that,
a classic movie. I got paid $15
bucks. Pretty darn good, but
no, he just said he thought the movie was good.
Keep doing the sketches and whatnot.
Oh, Paul was a very interesting experience because...
I wanted to ask, how did that compare to, your time in front of the camera to your time behind the scenes behind the camera?
You mean in that movie?
Doing your sketchboards.
Well, I'm always way up front, and the vision is being pounded out through the storyboarding process. And then I get lucky once in a while, and they say, hey, dumbhead, why don't you be the actor dumbhead guy? And I said, I can do that.
You play a clerk in that movie.
Yeah.
And it's very
Bill
funny.
Hader holds me up with a gun. That's pretty funny.
In a little, like Dark Lord bookstore or something like that.
Yeah, those Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are very funny guys. I'd be on the stage with them, and they'd be rehearsing, and I couldn't stop laughing. They were very funny guys. But appreciate the compliment. That's very nice.
The two of them together are like the new Abbott and Costello, I think.
John, thank you very much for your call today on Filmically Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great
Bye.
Show.
And I will just say, as an employee of the Library of Congress, yes, support your local library.
Yes.
Our man at the Library of Congress.
If you would like to get on the air with the film guys, call 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. It rings right through here to the studio, and you can ask any of the burning questions that you've always had. We have another caller on the line. In just a moment, we're going to go to Mike from Belmont, but I wanted to say another thing in the promo was, why can't J. Todd settle on a hairstyle? And that is because he does often do these cameos. So he goes off and draws a movie, and then they shoot it, but they ask him to get in it, and he comes back always with a wildly different head of hair.
Well, if you ever have the opportunity to go in front of the camera, just say, do whatever you want to. Don't complain about getting your hair cut or anything. Just say, whatever you want to do is fine. Your hair will go back. Just short of throwing acid on your face for good effect, you know, kind of stick with just letting them do whatever they want to do. Don't even think about it. Just let them, because on Leatherheads, Clooney was always giving me a crazy haircut. And that's, you know, they'll make fun of you like they do here at YSO, but it's worth it because you'll still get paid.
I think of Jack Nicholson in Chinatown. Didn't they actually cut his knife with the
knife?
I can't see that happening.
Just the very tip of it. Okay, we're going to have to look it up and get back to it. But so anything short of cutting your
cut
nose.
Jack Nicholson's
now my nose is going to itch for the rest of the program. Thanks a lot.
Hey,
remember when you cut my nose off for that movie? That was cool.
I think we've got next here Mike listening in Belmont. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, welcome to Filmically Perfect on 91.3 WYSO. And what's your question for the film guys?
Well, I've always heard stories about images that appear in film that may have sort of, I don't know, like subliminal or unconscious messages.
Symbolism in a way?
Yeah, and for example, like
the popcorn experiment.
In a particular scene, you know, a character is going to find redemption, or if there's an open window in the background of the scene, there's an opportunity coming for the character, or...
Oh, yeah, a lot of that. I mean, there was a time, as John was alluding to, the overt example is like the popcorn experiment back in the 50s where they actually did flash subliminal images.
Like just a single frame of some delicious food.
But I think what you're speaking more, are like things in the backgrounds that might sort of give you a clue of what's going to happen next. One of my favorites, and it starts out a little bit, and then by the end of the movie they're whacking you over the head with it. If you ever see the original version of Scarface from 1932, anytime a character dies in that movie, you will see an X in the scene somewhere, a shadow in the wallpaper, something like that. And even the opening credit, it has Scarface directed, blah, blah, blah. Behind the word Scarface is a big X. So all the way through that film are X's.
Now that's clearly intentional.
Very much intentional. In fact, there's a recreation of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in that one. They don't show you the guys getting shot. They go up to the rafters of the garage where there are like seven X's in a row as the...
Oh. You know, in the scene. Now, here's the scary part of that. What they were trying to do to force it, and now it's happening automatically nowadays. The audiences that watch movies are so sharp nowadays because of television
and the instant replay.
They are
on your DVD.
Able to spot two frames on a movement, and they will cut stuff. You watch your trailers; you're going to see stuff in there, and you're able to register these images. And part of that is because a lot of the images that you're used to seeing every day, like a car or simply a dog's head, that stuff has already been cut in your head before it happens. So they don't have to spend much time on there. Maybe a half a frame, even. They've even seen where people can pick up a half a frame.
Wow!
And the subliminal process is now well beyond anything they ever dreamed of, because I can tell you, I've been in the editing room enough to know that they've cut stuff so slim. And when this stuff goes out nowadays, people are freezing it to look at it.
Oh, you know, I do it.
The second and third pass, and then they're back and they're saying, look at that. Oh, I was so cool. I found a continuity error. Well, they're able to do that now.
There's a difference, though. I mean, there's the like subliminal, and then there's also the symbolic, which I get the feeling like in the silent film era, symbolism was just a lot more important. It was like an extra
Because you didn't have the way to vocally speak to these things, so you do it in images.
And that's
really what vocabulary.
My question is more the symbolic stuff. I mean, is there like a standard template of, you know, open doors mean opportunities?
No, it depends on the director. I mean, Hitchcock was a big one for that, and if you look at something like Spellbound's Spellbound's about psychological things anyway, so you've got doors opening and doors closing and snow, and at the end, probably one of the greatest moments in any of his films is at the end when one of the characters commits suicide, when he turns a gun on himself and fires. The original Prince had the gunshot tinted a bright red, so it was a psychological effect that jarred the audience. And as far as I don't know if they've done that on the new DVD. We do have an original print at work that has the two red frames in it.
But I can tell you as an artist, when I'm sitting down with a director and I'm starting to get a little tired and I can see where they're going, I just find an image that everybody understands.
Yeah.
A bow tie, And I put that in there, and before you know it, they picked that thing up so quick. So there is something to the images that we live with every day that are imprinted. And Scorsese has a really good commentary on that whenever you get to catch it anywhere. And he's talking about these imprinted images that
they're
look.
They're like icons.
For like the underside of a dog. Nobody knows what that really looks like. You don't see it. Believe me, I've been there, done that. Or steaks on a grill underneath that. You can't. That's not an image.
Right.
A rearview mirror. That is such a powerful tool that you can go anywhere with a rearview mirror. Just put a hand up there and you got it. You can go anywhere you want.
Very good. Thank you so much, Mike, for calling Filmically Perfect today.
Yeah, no, thanks. I'm a big fan.
Thanks, Mike.
I listen every week.
So. Oh, thank you so much.
You're the best, man.
I'll remind you that this is 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield. We're online at WYSO.org. We broadcast in HD, and we are a service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Speaking of things that you might draw in, we have a gentleman on the line here who has a very fundamental question for you. It's a pleasure to welcome Steve from Huber Heights. Steve, hello. Are you there?
Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
It's the Dakota Ring.
Oh, hello.
I like you already.
I've been listening to you guys ever since you came around.
We love a loyal listener.
I know it's a little simplistic after the subliminal images, but what the heck is a storyboard? I really don't know.
Well,
I'll sit down again.
It's called a paper rehearsal. Movies cost a lot of money, and they're a big gamble. So one of the ways to circumvent those high risk and cost are to quite simply draw a picture. Because no matter what you do, that script that everybody runs as a universal kind of language, words, has to become an image. And that's where it gets interesting in movies. You know, it has to go from that image. It has to go from that word, which is an intelligent thing, to an image, which is an existential thing. So how I figure in there is I draw the whole movie by hand, and then they shoot what I draw. And it's under the directorial orders.
So it cuts down on trial and error.
It just helps and control cost.
It started out actually in animation,
yes,
especially Disney and Max Fletcher,
right.
Because animation being so expensive, it was so – especially when sound came in, because they had to, you know, frame out everything to fit with the sound. So they would storyboard the entire movie, and you can actually see – if you go to some of the Disney websites or books, you'll see these walls full of drawings. So – and then, you know, as they went along, people found out about this process, and directors said, ooh, I can think this movie out ahead of time.
And they used to do – they cut the whole audio first, the vocalizations. Maybe it was rough, but – and then they had their bed, which was 2.5 minutes long or whatever it was supposed to be, and then they could drop the storyboards in on top – what we call an animatic now was how Disney did that. They called them pencil tests and things like that.
Oh, pencil test. Mm-hmm. I know that term. I didn't realize that's what that was.
So you're sort of the stage between the screenwriter and – say the cameraman.
Yes. There are many ways to make a movie, of course, but you can go straight from script to camera, which is a terrible burden, or you can make it easier on yourself and just kind of visualize what they're going to do before you do it. And that road from script to camera is where I play in there. Ever since I met the Coen brothers, they insisted on doing that because a lot of people go straight from script to camera, and what you got is chewing gum from the eyes. There's a lot of people standing around talking and being very, very fancy over the shoulder shots. But there's no exposition like really great movies like Duel. That is exposition.
Oh,
well, I was just thinking, if you want to see probably one of the best books about storyboarding that I've ever seen, I think we both have it, is the published screenplay to Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's called the Illustrated Screenplay, and it has the storyboards – intermingled with the script, and it shows how they worked out the special effects scenes and everything. It's really, really fascinating.
And that's what got me started in the business was that book.
No kidding.
Yeah, that was it. That was a book. Those guys came before me. They were the artists before my generation.
Yeah.
Now we have our own generation, which, you know, I'm sure there's going to be somebody else. But that's the book. I think George had it.
I have it.
And I went out of my mind over it. I had to find my own.
It must have been such a blind endeavor. I mean, the earliest movies, I'm getting the impression they didn't storyboard. They didn't have this little video thing that you could – I mean, it's almost
but
like
I mean,
it would be a great surprise.
Some of the films, like some of Griffith's early films, I mean, the cameraman couldn't even look through the camera.
That's right.
He just had to know, you know.
Well, what they had is marks on the floor. And they would figure out with just a rangefinder where the shot was, and then they'd close up the camera because no light could go through the camera, and they put tape on the floor, and that's where the focus puller would, you know, you'll notice in the older movies, the over the shoulder shots are back a little bit farther. So they used that shoulder to register what they were doing.
Oh, interesting.
Now they're closer actually, because they can look through the camera.
As far as
back
video,
then, they were safe.
As far as video assist is concerned, we may have spoken to this before.
We did, with
who
Jerry
it is?
Lewis and
Jerry
Men
Lewis,
that.
Yes. Jerry right. Lewis developed video assist.
Learned that from the film guys. And we make yes, such
it
fun
was,
of poor
it was
Jerry.
One of Jerry's great,
but you know
yes,
what's
brother.
What's really fascinating about those old movies is that the camera may be askew occasionally, but they're hardly ever out of focus. Even it's just every time I watch a really old movie like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is on our list, it's always in focus. Mm-hmm. And nowadays they can look through the camera, but they're always missing their focus. You know,
isn't that interesting? So almost like by sense of like a sixth sense for what's going on, because they were almost utterly blind until the film was developed and they got a chance to look mm-hmm. back at it.
I just think it's the studio.
I think they also had the
so
studio head behind them going, yeah. "You messed this up again. You're out of here.
You bring our starlet in there with the best take you ever did today." And it's out of focus. You're out of here,
you're
buddy.
Done. You'll never work in this town again.
Unless I need you.
Steve, thank you so much for calling
in
today.
I had a quick question about the list.
Okay.
Has A Lion in Winter made it onto there?
No, that's a darn good movie, though. We have to
it's
think about that.
Certainly one of my
that's
favorite.
A beautiful movie.
We'll have to...
Really is.
We'll that have to go into conference with Bud on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we have to go talk to Bud Enske. You know, over here at Weso, they have new studios. And if you come in to Yellow Springs, you'll see this tower. And at the 13th floor, which is the top, that's where Bud Enske runs Frozen Turkey Radio, which is us. And we are shoveling coal on hell down here just for him.
Just for him.
Bud Enske.
I think you know, we asked him about Lion in Winter one
yes.
time. He says, I don't like animal movies. So we'll try again.
Steve, thanks for calling in today.
Thank you, and guys.
Thank you.
If you would like to get on the air with the film guys, the number to call is 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. We are celebrating the kickoff of a brand new series of shows, new season of Filmically Perfect. We are
heck, we celebrate movies every week here.
I know. And we have come together, all together in person. It's just a delight to be looking at the both of you. And if you have had a question maybe about one of the shows, something that we've talked about, or something that you've just been intrigued at about the film guys themselves, the number to call, 800-776-0090. Again, toll free, 800-776-0090. We have kind of an interesting call here. A gentleman wants to describe a movie that he saw as a kid.
Man, no gesticulations, okay?
Yeah, William, are you there with us?
Yes.
William, you saw a movie some years ago. And
yeah, I mean, we're talking about when I was a little boy, and I remember the movie was so profound it made me cry. Mm. It was a Christmas coming home theme. Maybe because I was a little boy, I don't remember the actors and actresses, but I think maybe Barbara Stanwyck, I think maybe George Rapt, I think maybe Ronald Reagan.
Wow.
It was, and I haven't been able to find what
was the there
name
a chimpanzee
of it
is,
so
in
I
this
could
movie.
Even get it.
Do you remember any elements of the story besides the actors?
Well, there was one scene where either George Rapt or Ronald Reagan was in a big warehouse or something, and there was snow outside. And then at the end of the movie, he goes to this big house where there's a big Christmas party get-together or something.
Hmm.
I'm going to have to take this down, and I will
all
have
right,
to get,
I'll tell
well,
you
to get
what,
back to you on this.
Sarah, I'm going to put this call on hold. If you could grab his number, we're going to do a little bit of our own sleuthing. And William, we'll see if we can figure this out, and we'll get
great.
Back to you, all right?
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for calling. This is Filmically Perfect live on 91.3 WYSO, and you can get on and talk to the film guys. Maybe you've had that. I have. Yeah, that's kind of fun, the notion you can reach way back in there and someone could help you dust off the cobwebs. If you have any such questions at all, give us a call, 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. You guys both went to Wright State University together.
Correctly.
Yeah.
And what is it? There seems to be a prevailing wind of greatness that runs through this film school. Has it ever? Have you ever been able to in yourself think about what it is about this Dayton, Ohio, university named for the Wright brothers, right here in the middle of America, that seems to turn out a pretty seriously steady stream of great film people?
I thought this even when I was there that one of the nice things about Wright State's film school is, I mean, the what's bad about it is also what's great about it. I mean, the bad thing is that they don't have the access to the biz, the Hollywood biz. They can't really have a lot of people come in from the business. They can't have a lot of access to what Hollywood has to offer for the students that go to like UCLA or USC or something like that. But that's also a good thing because in exchange for that, they are forced to become the most creative filmmakers they can with the little that they have here in Dayton.
Necessity.
And also,
necessity is a mother.
Whose mother's in here now? When I got into wanting to make movies, I tried to apply at film schools and my grades weren't very good. It was just hopeless. But I went over to Wright State and went
this
in there.
This is true.
It's absolutely true. Wright State is like one of the greatest commodities in the film business that nobody really knows about. And I always tell people, well, I want to go to Columbia. Well, what do you want to go there for? You can go to Wright State. Wright State's the best film school. We've proven it. Look at all the people who are out there working. Eric Bork, Steve Bognar. Everybody's out there making movies, and they all came from Wright State. I just think it's just one of the most glorious, pearls that nobody knows about in the movie business. And I always tell people when I'm out working on movies, I'm running a lot of kids in Hollywood now from Wright State.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm, a lot. They have a group where they meet, I think, on Tuesday and Wednesdays. And I'm always out there working. I can't find where the group is.
I secretly imagine that the same sort of thing that's in the water that makes
Here's another cool thing about Wright State. When George and I was there, now Chuck has said that he was really frustrated because the equipment and everything was so junky. And
Chuck is?
Chuck Derry. He was our professor. And that was very frustrating but here's the thing. When George and I were there, we were just lucky to have all that equipment. Nowadays, it's so easy to make a movie, but back then it was very difficult because that equipment had to have separate sound, and we had 16-millimeter cameras and Super 8. But the cool thing was is when we were there, that stuff – we were instantly Orson Welles because we had stuff to make movies with. Nowadays, it's very easy. It's hard to understand that because you can do that with your video camera. But Wright State provided that opportunity back then. Now they have a really nice facility. And although that was kind of rough back then, we appreciated it. We loved it. We loved checking out cameras. It was just fascinating.
Well, and the idea of shooting, we actually shot our first major projects in Super 8 film, which is very hard to come by now. But shooting a film in Super 8 with a separate soundtrack and then editing, as we called it, spaghetti into a synchronized sound film. I mean, if you can survive that, then
let me tell you. Our eyes were awfully good back then. It was just a magical time for us because we'd have that equipment and we went out. And because we shot in Super 8, George and I shot in Super 8, we made more movies. Assisting was still expensive back then, especially. Yeah. But we could make 5 to 1 of their every movie, and sometimes they didn't even get their movies finished, but we were pounding them out.
Looking for your calls at 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. I had a call earlier this morning. A gentleman called in from Piqua, and he wanted to know specifically how it was that these rules got formulated. Was this a night after night of, like, intentionally trying to come up with rules? Or...
Yeah, that's what we do, man.
Yeah, night after night. We just keep working on it. But it is an interesting set, and he wanted to know how you settled on the three perfect movie rules.
I'm not sure exactly how we settled on them, but I think the sort of the genesis for it was that there, everybody and his uncle has a list of movies, and they always number them, 1 through 10.
We hate that.
And it became to us that a lot of the lists were kind of facetious, and it was always the same films, and it was either they're just, they're tagging on the back of somebody else. And we thought it would be good to come up with an idea for a set of rules that were our very own, that were incredibly subjective, so that no one else could really claim them.
Yes.
Yeah. And,
Well, I love them. I love these
rules. We've had quite a few nice compliments from art museums about it, too.
Really?
Because I hate when they make – like, who's to say a Peter Paul Rubens – is better than a Van Gogh.
That's maybe one of the things that I appreciate most, that these are not ranking. No. Here's not the best movie ever.
It's an appreciation.
This is a perfect movie. An appreciation.
That's what it is.
That's right. I mean, we could say just as much about Plan 9 from Outer Space as we could about Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
And actually, I like Plan 9 better.
But it's perfect in its own scale. And how many times do you say that's a perfect song or whatever? Like, what's that movie you always do, Down with Love?
Down with Love.
If that makes your heart sing up. And if that still makes you respond... You know, it's just like an old Beatles song. It'll still turn you on. That's why it's still classic in its own. It still has meaning, just as much meaning. Like Day the Earth Stood Still, that film is just as important now as it was when it came out.
That's right. So, like, Day the Earth Stood Still is kind of like When I'm 64, whereas Down with Love is more like Revolution Number 9. Or Why Don't We Do It in the Road?
So says you. 800-776-0090.
You see how this gets complicated?
It is complicated.
800-776-0090. Just about 15 minutes left in this show. Go ahead and get in line and get your questions to the film guys. And again, we're celebrating the kickoff of a brand new season of Filmically Perfect on WY. So our 6-year anniversary coming right up. And it's been a great, great ride. Do you have a perfect moment in one of the films that we've discussed that you'd like to share with the film guys, or maybe you'd like to take us to task on some of the information that we've sent your way? However you've ever thought about a film question, go to your phone and call 800-776-0090. And so, George, do you ever like wonder if you're thinking, okay, that film's awfully good, I'd like to see it again, and then go to your work at the Library of Congress, get the original off the shelf, put it on a machine, and just watch it to check for sure?
There have been times, yes.
Are you serious?
There have been, yes.
A couple of times
things that I've discovered, I'm like, oh, people have got to see this. I'll give you a good example. There's a Joan Crawford movie from the 50s called Queen Bee. And it's a great movie. I mean, it's really, really good. And she's just she's just wonderfully horrible.
Yeah.
And I finally saw it on DVD, and I was like, this is great. Oh, man, people got to see this. And it turned out we had a print of it at the library that came in through copyright that had looked like it had never been run. So I finally convinced them to show it as part of our regular series. And everyone's kind of like, well, no one knows this movie. I'm like, no, people will come to see it. And people came to see it. And I got so many compliments afterwards. That was great, you know, because it's just Joan Crawford at her wide-shouldered, angry
best.
Just severe.
Yeah.
So, yes, if you can find Queen Bee, highly recommend it. Great movie. But, yes.
We have another caller on the line here. It looks, in fact, well, I think that we've got David on the line here. Is this David?
Yeah.
David, welcome to Filmically Perfect.
Oh, thanks, Dave. I like your show quite a bit.
Thank you. We appreciate
that. I just
wanted
to say my son is in Beijing. He's been studying Chinese for a while, and he's talking about the definition of perfect and how his friends there chide him for how Americans say everything is perfect.
Because
they think that you know, is a little excessive. But he said that, like, oh, I'll meet you at 2 o'clock, just when I'm going to be there, isn't the same as perfect as they mean. But anyway, the characters that... are used to talk about perfect have end and beauty in them, almost like it means the end of beauty, and I thought that was a poetic way to describe it.
Interesting.
And I thought of that while listening to you, and
aww,
that's what I wanted to say. So thanks again, and keep it up.
Oh, thank you very much.
David, thank you so much. If you'd like thank you, and thanks for listening. If you would like to call 800-776-0090, you can talk to the film guys, and we're coming up just in the last 10 minutes of the show, so do call now if you've been thinking about that. Next up, we go to, I believe, actually, who do we have on the line here?
Scott. Hey, how are you doing?
Welcome to Filmically Perfect.
I'm working outside in this heat today. It's awful. Anyway, I was listening, and you were talking about movies that affected you. When I was a kid, I saw a movie called Charlie with Cliff Robinson.
Oh, yes.
Fantastic movie.
Yes, I
guess.
It's on our list. Another movie with Joan Crawford called Autumn Leaves. Very good movie.
I've heard of that one, but I hate to say I haven't seen that.
George has reached for a pencil.
I thought it was just going to be some sappy love story. It turned out to be kind of intense. Robertson plays this crazy person. Anyway, he's one of my favorite actors. Anyway, I had heard that he was blackballed from the business for a while when was he blackballed, and if you guys can allude as to why and what happened.
Yes, actually, I can't remember the name of the book. There's a really good book about Cliff Robertson's blackballing. What had happened was there was an executive who was head of Columbia Pictures named David Bagelman. And Bagelman, I can't remember, but there was some funny business about money being exchanged, and Bagelman was taking it, but he was putting it in Cliff Robertson's name, and Robertson found out about it and put the finger on Bagelman, and because Bagelman was so big, he was able to blackball Robertson.
So one of those classic, and you'll never work in this town again.
Basically, yeah. I mean, he got blackballed for telling the truth.
So, and blackballed means put on a list where people won't work with you, basically.
Exactly.
The rumor I heard was that he had communist sympathizer or something, but that's not true at all.
That may have been true. The only one I'm definitely sure about is the one, this was like in the 80s, 70s and 80s. So maybe that was the second time he was blackballed. So maybe he just got used to it after a while.
During the mid-60s when he did the movie Charlie, that was before or after he got blackballed? It was after, right?
If he was in the communist thing, that would have been afterwards, yeah. That was before the Bagelman episode.
Ah, I see. Yeah, when I was a kid and I saw that movie Charlie, it really, as a child, I thought he really was mentally challenged. And, you know, then I got older, you know, I just thought he was brilliant in the movie.
Yes. And see, that speaks to rule number three about, you know, despite changes in society or changes in you as a person, you became a person, you know, a different person as you became an adult, and this movie stuck with you. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Stick with me.
Very good.
Especially the crazy scene where he decides to sow his wild oats, and he's out there doing his crazy in clubs, you know, doing his crazy 60s psychedelic dance moves.
You know, we experimented on a guy like Charlie back when I worked at Reich's Warehouse, but it just didn't happen.
Oh,
he never got any smarter.
No.
So.
But he was still the president.
Yeah.
Thank you,
hey, you guys, take care.
Thank you much
for calling, Scott. Keep cool, all right?
You too.
We might have a chance to take a couple more calls, but you'd have to call right now at 800-776-0090. This has been a very special live edition of Filmically Perfect as we celebrate the kickoff of a brand new season. Stay tuned Friday afternoons and Sunday mornings as we'll be presenting brand new episodes of this great WISO original show, 800-776-0090.
We want to thank all those church people for running out of church to sit in the car and listen to us instead of going to lunch. I get a lot of calls from you in between church and lunch, and boy, we sure appreciate that, you know?
We go to Randy in Bellbrook, and you have, I guess, a sort of a personal preference and then a suggestion. Randy.
Yeah.
What's your notion for the film guys today?
Well, I had a question to see if they had any more examples of something that occurred to me. Speaking of high-speed sequences, subliminal storyboarding, etc., I was reminded of the opening montage or setup sequence in the 2001 French romantic comedy Amélie.
Oh, it's quite good, yeah.
And in the first 3 or 4 minutes, it is basically a nano-movie in itself that tells the life story of the central character up until the main, you know, plot gets underway.
Isn't a gnome figure in there?
Excuse me?
Is there a gnome? Is there a plaster gnome that figures in there? Or am I confusing the two with another movie?
Not sure about the gnome.
I thought it was father.
I think the director of that was also responsible for Delicatessen.
Yes.
Which is a perfect movie. And the opening of Delicatessen, the title sequence is like that, where all the junk and imagery that mixes in with the titles all kind of plays with the story and also alludes to the people who are being credited. I mean, I really love it when they can take title sequences like that and actually work them into the picture itself.
Now, the cinematographer on that picture is actually just done Joel and Ethan's movie that we finished in March or April, and his name is Bruno... I always have a hard time pronouncing his name.
Looks like Delbonnel.
Delbonnel, very nice guy, and he's responsible for a lot of that imagery because he's so skilled. The camera.
It's almost like a sub skill in itself to do this exposition.
Well,
quick,
he works with that director
quick,
really
quick.
Well. He works with that director very spectacularly well. Nice guy.
Thanks so much for calling, Randy.
Okay.
And thanks for listening to Filmically Perfect. We got one call on the line. If you wanted to get on, you should call this moment at 800. 800-776-0090. That's 800-776-0090. And it rings right through here to the studio. We have a call that actually kind of is after my own heart. Yeah, we welcome Joe listening in Germantown. Joe, welcome to Filmically Perfect.
Hi. Love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yay.
My question is, I wonder if you film guys ever worry about running out of perfect film.
Nah, there's just not. It's hard enough for us to get back in the studio to do this, let alone run
there,
out of
There
films.
Are many of them. There's some I'm still discovering. I'm amazed. Even where I work there, we have stuff hidden in corners and things that have just gone under the radar for years that are coming out. And I'm like, where was this?
Yeah,
where
and
was
our this listeners.
And some of them are major things, and I totally miss them, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be on our next group.
Our listeners give us some really fine. We always encourage them. Tell us your favorite movies, because that way we can steal from you and use them.
Which is it's a great way to communicate with the film guys. By the way, we get a lot of nice emails.
If we do run out of good ones, we can do a whole year of guilty pleasures.
Yeah,
no,
we could talk about Down with Love forever.
And Love Actually.
Yeah, Love Actually.
Yeah.
No more, no sort of almost perfect movies.
That's kind of what our guilty pleasures are.
Well, that's where Budinsky comes in.
Yeah.
Right.
Great, thanks.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you so much. Great question. Thanks for calling. Mm-hmm. I think we've got one more caller on the line, and that'll probably be the last one. Although, if you wanted to call real quick, you might be able to get through at 800-776-0090. That's, again, toll-free, 800-776-0090. We go now to Dayton and Tony. Hello, welcome to Filmically Perfect.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, I was remembering, I enjoy your show for one.
Thank you.
I was remembering back when I was a kid, probably back in the 70s, my mother had dropped my little brother and I off at the Victoria Theater to watch a movie called Fantastic Planet. And it was an animated film.
Yes,
but,
French animated film.
For kids.
Oh, not yes. For kids. But because it was a cartoon, everyone assumed it was. Is that right?
Right. Well, I think that's what my mother's thought was when she dropped us off. And it just opened our world up with her.
Yeah, boy.
A lot of concepts and
My mom took us.
Oh, that's hilarious.
My mom took us to see The Revenants when we were young, thinking that it was a good, wholesome picture, too.
Yeah, Fantastic Planet is a French animated feature, which, unfortunately, I have never seen it. I've read about it, and I've seen pictures from it. For a long time, it was kind of unavailable. I believe it has just come out in, I guess, a really nice – I think it's out in a nice new DVD, so we may have to go out and check
now,
that one out.
Now, see, just hearing Tony, that's not for kids, that piques my interest right away.
Well, it's French.
And you know, the French only make films. We make movies.
You know, we're just about out of time. I think, Tony, that you'll be our last call. Or you know what? Actually, there's one more we'll get to. But, Tony, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tony.
And stay tuned.
Okay.
We go now to, I believe, we have Eric listening in Dayton. We just have just a minute left. Eric, you have a question for the film guys.
Yeah, guys, I've been listening to you on and off for the past year or so, and I haven't had a chance to actually check your list. So I was wondering, is Jeremiah Johnson on there?
Oh, you should remember, the film guys both paused, took a breath, and looked at one another.
You know, it's a really great, it's directed by a really good
Pollock.
Yeah, I think that's on there.
That,
because,
I believe it is on there.
Because
we just
it's
need
so
to get
cinematic.
To
there's not much dialogue, right. Which means instantly we're interested.
Right,
you know? So,
right.
Yeah,
it is, and it's so different for Redford. I mean, it's a really good film for him.
People love that movie, man.
So yes, let me put that on my list for
consideration.
That's how we do it.
And we can run that by Budinsky. Eric, thank you so much. You're the last caller today on our very special live edition. Thanks for calling, Eric.
Thank you.
And do stay tuned in the weeks to come. Filmically Perfect will be offering up brand new seasons, brand new editions as we enter our seventh season officially of this great film show on public radio. That's the
how apropos.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, and stay tuned. We're going to be putting it up on the line. You can get us at iTunes, at npr.org, at yso.org, or you can go to the source at perfectmovie.net. If you'd like to write to the film guys and any questions that you would like to ask or suggest a perfect film, we always love to hear from you. It's filmguys at perfectmovie.net. That's filmguys at perfectmovie.net. Gentlemen, we're going to be at Film Dayton taping live there and other things coming
and
down.
George
the
is going to do his Library of Congress.
That's right. They'll be showing these amazing shadows at Film Dayton this year.
Yeah.
But his something to behold.
George's show, George's exposition on the Library of Congress is absolutely fantastic. Do not miss it.
Do not miss it. Check it out. The upcoming events for Film Dayton. It's coming up in August. We'll be there taping live. And George Willeman, by the way, this documentary that they did, they came to the Library of Congress to talk about some of these old films. Mm-hmm. And when they got back to you, they had changed the name. And
took the title from something I said in an interview.
You said, hey, I like the name. It's pretty good. They go, well, you said it. Yeah. So there's a lot to that. Keep your eyes pointed to George Willeman, Nitrate Archivist for the Library of Congress, and great, great film guy. George, thank you for being here.
And thanks to our studio audience.
Yay!
And thanks to J. Todd Anderson, storyboard artist for the Coen Brothers, and just an all-around great guy. J. Todd, we got our eye on you, and we'll be up to some fun soon, all right?
Get your fingers out of my hair right now.